Welcome to the Augsburger Lecture Series. I want to thank Myron Augsburger for being here and initiating these wonderful talks and lectures that we do have. My name is Barry Hart from the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. And as you can read here, the lecture tonight is from Greensboro to Gulepolje. What is Gospel Mission to the Historically Violated? The Center for Justice and Peacebuilding at EMU is very pleased to sponsor this particular lecture tonight, and we want to welcome our presenters, Elaine Enns and Jed Myers. At the heart of restorative justice and building peace, you find people committed to the principles and practices of love. These individuals walk humbly but also courageously with their God as they plant the seeds of justice and nonviolent action and participate in that action. They are committed to planting as well as watering these seeds without necessarily experiencing the harvest. I suspect from what I know of Elaine and Ched that they are committed to this vision and way of doing peace. I have a long list of their accomplishments and degrees and so forth. I don't know if I'll go through them, just maybe some. Elaine has a Master's of Arts in Conflict Management and Peacebuilding Theology from Mennonite Brethren Biblical Seminary in Fresno, California. She has been involved for 20 years or more in working in the field of restorative justice and conflict transformation as a victim-offender dialogue facilitator, consultant, educator, trainer. Elaine has taught at a number of universities and is currently teaching part-time at the Peace and Justice Academy of Pasadena, California. She's also the director of the Restorative Justice and Conflict Transformation Program of the Bartimus Cooperative Ministries in Oak View, California, and co-founder, this is a tongue twister, of the Word and World School for Faith-Based Activist. Ched holds a master's degree in New Testament Studies from the Graduate Theological Union in Pasadena, or in Berkeley, California. His theology is radically practiced through his writings and work for social change in North America and countries abroad. He writes about himself, "I have sought to respond to the discipleship call as an activist, writer, community builder, and popular educator. It is my conviction that the First World Church can only be renewed by rediscovering its witness to God's dream of the peaceable kingdom and justice for all." Ched animates scripture, lectures in seminaries throughout the United States and elsewhere, and he is particularly committed to faith-based peace and justice efforts, such as Christian peacemaker teams, Border Links, the Catholic Workers Movement, and several others. Ched will speak first about the Greensboro Truth and Community Reconciliation Projects. He's going to look at the history of that and look at it through a gospel-based lens of healing past injustices. And then Elaine will outline the legacy of Mennonite refugees from the Ukraine, and she tells me that all of her grandparents are from the Ukraine, but those who came in the early 20th century, and she'll look at restorative justice issues of these particular people in the current day circumstances. So would you welcome with me Elaine and Ched?
Early church sure is arriving late.
Thank you all for coming, early church.
Indeed. Yeah, and thank you all for being here and for finding this room. We want to begin, as is proper, by thanking Myron and Esther in absentia for all the ways that they nurture the life of faith and witness here on campus, and particularly for these lectureships, which have brought us here. And for the first time, we're at the end of a pretty intense 48 hours, for which we give thanks to God that we've made it through the gauntlet. It's been a really wonderful time talking not only with professors and students, but also with wonderful people in the community. So, Myron, thank you for making things like this possible, and for continuing to encourage critical conversation about issues that matter. We hope that tonight will be part of that conversation. So we're going to get at it. We're going to do this a little differently than was outlined. We're just going to sort of weave these stories together. everybody here all right and see all right? We're not standing in the way. You can reposition yourself. We'll maybe try to do that this way. Everybody here all right? Great. Here's this text. You all are familiar with it. It's always a good starting place, particularly for something like the Augsburger Lecture, which is about evangelism and mission. In this famous commission, we are reminded by Menno that true evangelical faith is not about doctrinal purity, nor the number of souls we can notch up on our belt having been saved, but really about engaged practices of compassion and justice. And we want to highlight two things here that Menno notes: the work of comforting the sorrowful and binding up the wounded. So this takes us to the heart of the topic we want to address in this second lecture. Last night we looked at the inextricable connection between Christian conversion and the vocation of restorative justice. And we overviewed the range of peacemaking tools and competences that our churches and movements need to nurture and practice. And a great deal of that training is happening here at EMU. And like all of us, you all can go broader yet and deeper still into this work. But one of the most difficult cases all of us as peacemakers and healers face is the issue of historical violation. The sins of the past, the traumas that were engendered by it and which continue in our bones. It's tough for lots of reasons, not least of which is we obviously cannot intervene in past violence, nor can we in most cases bring victims and offenders together because many of them have passed on. But we know are making ever more sophisticated study of the fact that violation and violence breed trauma, and trauma resides in our psyches and our souls and our bones long past the events. This means that healing is a long-term intergenerational task of peacemaking for which our churches can and must be prepared. And we think, Myron, that this is one of the things that needs to be at the heart of the mission of the church, particularly in the wake of the 20th century, that bloodiest of epochs, which has manufactured trauma at a rate that previous generations could not possibly have imagined. So we want to explore this work through the prism of two particular chapters of historic political violence, one that happened pretty close to here, the other that happened half a world away. and these stories are not necessarily your story or my story, but we hope that you will pay very careful attention to the particularity of these stories in order that all of us might find in them the universal issues which we need to be attending to. So with that, I want to turn it over to Elaine to tell a story that is very particular to her branch of the Mennonite movement. And then we will look in the middle to, at the story of the Greensboro Massacre, and then we will return to the story of Gulai Pol. So, Elaine.
6 weeks ago, I, along with my oldest sister, walked up to the Schultzfabrik in the former Mennonite village of Ostrovik in Ukraine. This was a long-awaited pilgrimage to the place my ancestors came from. We could see that the Schultz factory had once been a magnificent building, with intricate brickwork around the windows and an impressive archway for horse and buggy to enter the compound. To our left, down a muddy lane, was our great-grandparents' home, and then beyond that was the house where my grandmother, Schultz, grew up. After wandering around the factory for a while, we made our way towards my grandma's home. We were disappointed to find that it was surrounded by a 10-foot fence, and our tour guide, Tatiana, warned us not to go in. Bad, very bad dogs. And we had indeed seen some very vicious guard dogs over the last 10 days. But I whistled and I hollered, and when no dogs appeared, and knowing that we would probably never be here again, we got on our backs in the mud and slithered under the fence. And Tatiana, yeah, and Tatiana stood on the other side, shaking her head. She was very responsible for us and worried. Both the home, both homes and the factory had been turned into collective housing during the communist era, but it was clear that no one currently lived in this house. The back door of the house was ajar, so we made our way in. Straight ahead, we saw the staircase leading to the grand room. So we picked our way up those rickety stairs, careful to step only on the sides because the center of the steps were broken through. The last few stairs were missing altogether, so we stretched out on our bellies, straining to see the second floor. It was nothing like the grand room we had been told about as children. The roof and most of the floor was gone, and we learned later that a few years ago, a homeless man had perished in a fire he had started, which had gutted the building. As I gazed upon this blackened skeleton of what had once been the heart of a Mennonite household, the weight of what happened almost a century ago was too much to bear. From its beginnings, the Anabaptist movement knew a lot about displacement. As you well know, Mennonites were heavily persecuted and chased all over Europe. And by the 17th century, many had settled in Prussia. The late 18th century saw a major migration of Prussian Mennonites to southern Ukraine. They had been invited by Catherine the Great, the Tsarina of Russia, because of their reputation as hard-working farmers who had proven successful at cultivating marginal lands. My people come from this wing of the Mennonite movement. They flourished in Ukraine and Russia for almost 150 years, living in autonomous German-speaking villages. Catherine granted them religious freedom, including exemption from military service, in exchange for Mennonites pioneering the steppe lands of southern Ukraine. The Schultz family, my maternal grandmother, were entrepreneurs who built a machine factory at the turn of the 20th century, manufacturing farm equipment which was eventually used all over Russia. But the prosperity of some of the Mennonite villages contrasted starkly with the lot of both the majority of Russian peasants, who had only been liberated from serfdom one generation earlier, and the emerging urban industrial working class. The profound disparities between the landed gentry and the poor throughout Tsarist Russia had bubbled up in an aborted revolution coup in 1905. World War I further exacerbated social and economic tensions throughout the archaic Tsarist regime. All of these contradictions came to a head in the October Revolution of 1917, led by Vladimir Lenin. After the Tsarist regime was overthrown by the Bolsheviks, 3 years of civil war ensued throughout Russia. In Ukraine, the fighting was the bloodiest. Battles raged back and forth between three armed forces: the Red Army of the Soviets, the White Army of former Tsarist supporters, which was backed by the West, and the formidable forces of Ukrainian nationalists and anarchists. These battles had raged right through the yard we were now standing in. Mennonite villages were ravaged during this time for three basic reasons. One, they appeared pro-German. Two, they were materially secure. And three, as pacifists, they did not fight back. As a child, I learned the name of Nestor Makhno. Makhno, a Ukrainian peasant, had reportedly worked as a youth on Mennonite farms. At age 17, he was arrested for anarchist political activity and spent 10 years in a Moscow jail. And he was freed during the 1917 revolution. Makhno returned to his home of Gulaipol in the heart of southern Ukraine and proximate to many Mennonite villages. He emerged as a leader of peasant dissatisfaction and built the most successful anarchist army in history. On one hand, the Makhnovists fought brilliant guerrilla campaigns and redistributed wealth throughout Ukrainian villages. On the other hand, they were often irrationally brutal and violent, and they frequently commandeered Mennonite estates as their headquarters. One notorious example is the massacre of Eichenfeld. On one October night in 1919, Makhno's forces wiped out most of the men, murdering 136 people and raping many of the women. 2 months later, Christmas 1919, Makhno and his men came to the Schultz Fabrik. The men of the house, of course, had to flee into the nearby forest, and the girls and young women were hid. My grandmother was 15 years old, and along with her sister and six girl cousins, was hidden in the attic for 2 weeks. It is difficult for me to believe, but according to my aunt and the stories that have been passed down in my family, none of these women were violated. Meanwhile, my great-grandmother and her young boy served Makhno and his men meals. In the face of terror, my great-grandmother practiced hospitality. After 2 weeks, Makhno and his men expropriated all of the remaining resources and the horses, and they left. As I lay on my stomach viewing the remains of the great room, I imagined my 15-year-old grandmother listening through the attic floorboards as her mother met the demands of these rough peasant soldiers. And I wondered how my great-grandmother, at age 48, endured this ordeal. I grew up hearing these stories of what were called the days of terror, and they were etched into my consciousness. All four of my grandparents were refugees to Canada as a result of these terrible events, but most of their family never made it out. Yet, as a practitioner of restorative justice over the last 20 years, I have learned that the truth of violation is always more complicated. In working with offenders, I have learned that they too have a secret history of their own sorrow and suffering, as Longfellow famously put it. My recent pilgrimage to Ukraine was in order to make sense of the full and more complex history of my Mennonite ancestors through the lens of restorative justice. But it is what I learned over the last decade in my involvement with a pioneering project that has provided a broader and deeper framework to do this work. So let's take a short divergence from Gulai Pol, Ukraine, to Greensboro, North Carolina, and the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission to take place on U.S. soil.
Elaine and I have had the opportunity to work closely with the Greensboro Truth and Community Reconciliation Project because of longstanding friendship with its primary animator, Reverend Nelson Johnson. We think that Reverend Johnson comes as close in character and conviction to the late Dr. Martin Luther King as anyone of the last generation, and we consider him a very important mentor. In fact, we'll be going from here to Greensboro to sit with him. Elaine interviewed him for her second volume of the Ambassadors of Reconciliation book a few years ago, specifically about the TRC. Nelson grew up near Greensboro and for 5 decades has been involved in struggles for justice, particularly around issues of race and labor. He's today a pastor of a small congregation which houses a number of grassroots initiatives in his low-income African-American neighborhood. Greensboro has been at the crossroads of civil rights and racial justice history. On February 1st, 1964, students from North Carolina A&T University sat down at a Woolworth's lunch counter to protest segregation and started a direct action movement that re-energized the civil rights movement and eventually changed this country forever. But on November 3, 1979, Nelson and other labor organizers from the Communist Worker Party were preparing for a legal rally through a working-class black neighborhood in Greensboro. They were addressing unjust labor practices and racism in the local textile mills. Folk were gathering to begin the demonstration, young children, old folk coming out of the projects to join the singing, when suddenly a caravan of 9 cars carrying members of the Ku Klux Klan and American Nazi Party drove toward the organizers. The Klansmen stopped their cars, walked around, calmly opened the trunk and pulled out weapons, and commenced firing into the crowd. In 88 seconds, they killed 5 leaders of the march and wounded 10 others, all of it captured by local television cameras. The neighborhood was terrorized. The city was thrown into shock. Slain were a Latino community organizer, 2 white medical doctors, a black activist, and a white researcher, all dear friends and colleagues of Nelson's and leaders of the organizing movement. Earlier, Nelson had obtained a parade permit from the city, but only on the condition stipulated by the Greensboro Police Department that he sign a document stating that none of the demonstrators would carry weapons. He had been assured of police escort. But all of the officers assigned to the parade were mysteriously sent to an early lunch just before the Klan and Nazis arrived. It was learned later that the Greensboro Police Department was fully aware of the Klan's plans via a paid informant that they had hired, who was a leader in the confrontation. The white attackers all escaped serious injury, while Nelson and other organizers were charged with inciting a riot. The day after the massacre, local newspapers reported that Klansmen had attacked a legally scheduled parade. But within 2 days, the local press, desperate to salvage Greensboro's reputation of civility, The papers changed their story, asserting that the incident was a shootout between two extremist groups from out of town. Despite the fact that four television crews had captured the killings on film, the shooters were acquitted by all-white juries in two separate ensuing trials. Yet another lamentable instance in the long, sordid history of racist Southern justice. Finally, in 1985, a third civil trial found for the first time in American history that police had been jointly liable with white supremacists for one wrongful death. But the entire community of Greensboro continued to suffer from the trauma of November 3rd, 1979. But most chose to suppress those events from the collective memory, leaving it up to the victims, represented now by the Greensboro Justice Fund, to try to continue to tell the truth of that conflict in the larger context of protracted, entrenched racial and economic injustice. It was this group, made up of the survivors and led by Nelson Johnson, to try to help Greensboro face its past. Using some of the precedents set by the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Nelson and others at the turn of the millennium launched a truth and community reconciliation project, bringing this process to the United States for the first time. The project was supported by people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who met with the organizers on several occasions. In 2002, the TRC organizers began formal outreach to the community. A broad community consultation process followed. In March 2003, the project invited 17 different factions from across the spectrum of the Greensboro community, from city officials to grassroots organizations, to name representatives to form a committee, which in turn would select seven commissioners. 14 groups made nominations. Not surprisingly, three declined to participate: the Sons and Daughters of the Confederacy, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Greensboro Police Department. In all, 67 people were nominated as commissioners, and seven eventually were chosen. Despite a great deal of public opposition, the commissioners were installed on June 12, 2004, by U.S. House Representative Mel Watt, former Greensboro Mayor Karen Allen, and District Court Judge Lawrence McSwain. Over 500 people attended to show their support. At the same time, Klan members were sending death threats to the commissioners, one of which said, "The only reconciliation we want is at the end of a gun." Undaunted, the commission held three public hearings, and over 200 people presented testimony. This included the judge that presided over the original criminal case, members of the Klan and Nazis, survivors, and residents of the traumatized Morningside community. Hundreds of people gathered to listen to riveting testimony. It was an amazing process, despite significant popular and official resistance, including the sitting mayor of Greensboro going out of his way to undermine the process at every turn, as this quote shows. The Greensboro Project affirmed the motto of the South African process: without truth, there can be no healing. Without forgiveness, there can be no future. A new era has been launched in the wake of this historic project for all of those who have suffered historic injustices in the United States. As the commission was forming, dozens of community leaders from around the country came to Greensboro to learn how to organize their own truth and reconciliation processes for riots that had happened in 1910, lynchings that had happened in 1928, and so on. The TRC process saw the despair of historic silence give way to restorative truth-seeking. And we were honored to serve as advisors to this project. On a number of occasions, we spoke to organizers about how the TRC process could advance principles of restorative justice. And Elaine's going to talk a little bit about that.
Most of you will be familiar with the three basic questions that guide restorative justice work, as developed by your own Howard Zaire. The Greensboro TRC attempted to address each of these questions in the case of the politically motivated violence of November 3, 1979. Who was harmed? Those harmed by November 3rd were not only the 5 people killed and 10 people wounded and their family and friends. An entire community was traumatized by this eruption of race and class violence, which was exacerbated by denial and cover-up by city officials and the dominant media. And one could argue that the whole regional South, still trying to live into the new era in the wake of the civil rights movement, was set back. Assessing the needs of these various parties harmed in Greensboro and how to address them, therefore, is complex but crucial. We provide a full analysis of these issues in the appendix of our Ambassadors of Reconciliation, Volume 2, if you're interested in pursuing these ideas. Here, I just want to make a few comments about what the TRC taught me to look for in my consideration of the Mennonite legacy in the Ukraine. This is a list for those of you in the restorative justice work. It will look very familiar to you. These has been gathered over the years, some of the needs of crime victims. And I just want to highlight 2 for our purposes here. 1, the need for information, answers, and meaning. We see interesting differences between the experience of crime and politically motivated violence. The victim of a carjacking who perceives crime as random may well wonder why she was attacked. But victims of political violence usually know exactly why attacks happen and why they were targeted. And this was the case in Greensboro. Their problem was that the public was not clear about or refused to acknowledge the political motivations and injustices involved, thus isolating the victims further. But public understanding is a long-term educational project. As Nelson points out, one cannot properly interpret the massacre without taking into account the historical matrix of race and class oppression in the Mid-South. In this sense, the work of the Greensboro TRC is necessary but not sufficient. The long-term goal is to transform the bigger story of race and labor relations. I also want to point out the work of surviving, victims' work of surviving and transcending. In talking with victims of violent crime, I have heard some of them refer to their journey from victim to survivor to healer. The victims of the 1979 massacre moved from being survivors to healers by taking the initiative to organize the TRC. Part of transcending the violence was being able to recognize the humanity of the perpetrators. Nelson, on a number of occasions during the TRC, personally reached out to Klan members and listened empathetically to them in private conversations. Here are some ways in which we think the Greensboro Commission's work provides a model of restorative justice applied to issues of historic violation and systemic inequality. The Greensboro Commission dared to analyze how social power is distributed in the community and to address structural issues, understanding that these lay at the roots of the violence. It examined chronic places of systemic violence in the community and why these conditions persist. It called for accountability from perpetrating persons and institutions, including difficult and contentious concerns around police complicity, media misrepresentation, and political silencing. It provided a safe space for victims, offenders, and their families and community members to tell their story and to listen to others. It pioneered a process of historical revisitation, truth-telling, and the power of testimony. The public processing of pain is difficult, and we in North America and our governments do not do that well. It offered public acknowledgement of people's pain, enabling all parties to begin to move past trauma by moving through it. It called for a measure of reparation, if primarily through public monuments and revising official city history. And these acknowledgments were crucial for healing the past. It attempted to outline what community recovenanting might look like, with all sectors of Greensboro urged to take responsibilities for the past and also for the future. And most importantly, it called for concrete political and structural change. Nelson rightly insists that exercises in historical truth-telling must lead to real social change in order to fulfill their purpose. The civil rights movement would not have meant as much, he points out, if it had not ultimately led to the overturning of segregation laws. The experience of the Greensboro TRC gives hope that by heeding the famous dictum of historian and philosopher George Santayana, we will face the past in order not to be condemned to repeat it. But this same truth was also asserted by the great psychotherapist Sigmund Freud as an intrapsychic ultimatum. Namely, that which remains lodged in our unconscious will render us captive to repetition compulsion. Or, as Jesus put it even more succinctly, only the truth can set us free. This brings us back to the question of how healing historic wounds can be part of the church's mission and my pilgrimage to Ukraine. The hard work by the survivors, healers of the Greensboro massacre, inspired me to investigate what similar commitments might look like in the case of the bitter legacy of my Russian Mennonite ancestors. The dominant story that we in the Canadian Mennonite community still tell centers on our victimization during the Russian Revolution. And the truth of this is undeniable. More than three quarters of the Mennonite population in Russia either perished or were exiled to Siberia and never heard from again. But historical political trauma rarely sorts neatly into pure victims or perpetrators. Moreover, if traumatized people stay in a place of victimization, our healing process can be severely jeopardized. For example, there is a disproportionate rate of both Alzheimer's and depression within the Canadian Prairie Mennonite community, and both diseases have made a profound impact on my own family. I and others wonder whether post-traumatic stress resides in the bones of our people, and perhaps explains this epidemic even into my nieces and nephews' generation. Through my research and travel, I am identifying a series of difficult questions that must be pressed if we Russian Mennonites are to find healing and restorative justice from this past trauma. For example, did the Prussian Mennonites the Prussian Mennonite emigrants in the 1780s unwittingly displaced the traditional inhabitants of the Ukrainian steppes. I learnt that the Nogai and Cossack people had in fact been forcibly removed by Catherine the Great prior to my ancestors arriving. So here is a case of complex historical truth. Mennonite exiles from one part of Europe end up exiling indigenous peoples in another part of Europe. And a people desiring only religious freedom end up being used in a wider imperial scheme to colonize the frontier. and it gets even more complicated. The Mennonites who did make it out of Russia in the 1920s, including my grandparents, came as refugees to the Canadian prairies. They were given or bought land in areas that had recently been taken from Cree tribes by the Canadian government. So here again, Mennonite victims in one part of the world who were trying only to survive were unwittingly complicit in the disenfranchisement of First Nations people half a world away. And it is no accident that today there are land claim conflicts between Mennonite farmers and Cree tribes in my home province of Saskatchewan. A second question. What lay beneath Ukrainian peasant hostility towards my Mennonite ancestors? I am discovering two inconvenient truths here. One is that in most cases our people were not targeted because they were Mennonite, but because they were wealthy. Rich Ukrainian kulaks, Jews, and other German-speaking religious communities, such as the Baptists and the Lutherans, were also hit hard, particularly by the anarchists and the communists. The other is not only was there significant wealth disparity between Mennonites and their peasant neighbors, there was also disturbing internal economic stratification in the Mennonite colonies. Many landless Mennonites became servants on wealthy estates. In fact, some disillusioned Mennonites even joined the communists or the anarchists to fight for a more just society. So the same social fault lines that led to the Russian Revolution ran right through my grandmother's estate. I remember as a child asking my father why this horror happened in Russia, and he replied simply, "We got too rich." A third set of questions involves the spectrum of Mennonite responses to the violence and terror inflicted on them. On one end of the spectrum, the horrors led some young Mennonite men out of desperation to abandon their pacifism in order to try to defend their families and communities. They organized a self-defense unit called the Selbstschutz, in some cases armed only with their hunting rifles, but in other instances, they were resourced and trained by the White Army. Makhnevites were particularly angry about the Selbstschutz because from their perspective, it represented a disturbing contradiction. The Mennonites would not fight for their Ukrainian neighbor peasant liberation, but they fought against the Makhnevites, even allying themselves with the hated White Army. Perhaps inevitably, these Mennonite armed attempts to defend themselves led to more severe reprisals. It's very likely, for example, that the Eichenfeld massacre was a response to the Selbstschutz. On the other end of the spectrum stand the many Mennonite women who actually nursed sick Makhnevists back to health. A counterintuitive but deeply nonviolent response. And this brings me back to the extraordinary way in which my great-grandmother set a table for her enemies. Faced with the crisis of a home invasion and still mourning her sister and three nephews who had earlier been murdered by the Makhnevists, she somehow coped with their crude language and gestures, their drunkenness, and the illnesses they brought with them. And yet she fed them and clothed them, took care of their wounds and fevers. There is evidence that her actions may have, in fact, warded off worse violence. These challenging questions stand at the center of my effort to make sense of events almost a century ago through the lens of restorative justice. I believe it is important for us to revisit these ethical and political dilemmas from our Anabaptist past because they can inform the shape of our future witness. So to restate my three questions. How does this legacy in Ukraine illustrate ways in which victims somehow, sometimes, also become unwitting victimizers in the larger political scenario? And how can we sensitively but courageously deal with a more complex history, knowing that, as Longfellow put it, there is sorrow and suffering enough all around? What are ways in which Mennonite affluence put us on the wrong side of a social revolution a century ago? And what does that mean for Mennonite class positioning today? Can we Mennonites nuance our interpretation of the Maknavist movement in order to acknowledge how it expressed peasant aspirations for social justice? It may surprise you to know, it certainly would my relatives, that today Makhno is still revered in anarchist circles and publicly honored in Ukrainian monuments. And so it is no longer accurate nor helpful for Mennonites to continue to refer to the Maknavists as mere bandits or terrorists, given the highly conflictive context of revolutionary Russia. Even more challenging, but nevertheless germane, is it possible to consider that Anabaptists might actually imagine a degree of common cause with anarchism's rejection of the centralized state? After all, the Soviet state that the anarchist Makhno fought against proved severely oppressive to Mennonites. Thirdly, how should we assess both the abandonment of pacifism by the Zelbstutz in the face of the horrific violations experienced during the Russian Revolution, as well as the creative nonviolent responses, such as my great-grandmother's, to the crisis? And what lessons can we learn for our contemporary peace witness?
So, in an attempt to summarize these stories and this analysis, we think there are at least three important lessons from the experience of the Greensboro TRC that invite us to view the political violence of the Ukraine story differently. And these might be discussion points. Firstly, it's pretty clear that healing will never come unless the entire story is uncovered. In the case of Greensboro, Nelson Johnson apologized for the way in which provocations of the demonstrators who were part of the labor parade may have precipitated some of the backlash from the Klan. He acknowledged where he made mistakes. And he earned respect because of his honesty and humility, even though by doing that publicly, Nelson, who many people still believe is the most dangerous man in North Carolina, even though his humility and confession played into the hands of those who are ever stand ready to try to vilify him. What would it look like for Canadian Mennonites to own up to ways in which their ancestors were complicit in social conditions that led to the violence of the Russian Revolution, that victimized them? Because remember, only the whole truth can set us free. Secondly, it's really important to keep emphasizing, particularly in the trauma work that many of you are working with here, that political violence can never be understood outside its social context. In the case of Greensboro, that was a place that suffered from centuries of apartheid, racialized justice, and class disparity. And attempts to ignore that context after the November 3rd massacre inevitably trivialized the responses of local leaders, as if November 3rd was had nothing to do with that longer history. Similarly, in Ukraine, the wounds inflicted by the Tsarist regime in Russia went deep, from the displacement of Tatars and Cossacks to the exploitation of peasants and industrial workers. And here's a point came up in one of the classes today. The Mennonite attempt, indeed the culture, to live aloof from the social and political context where they were in Ukraine, which was rationalized by an ideology of being the quiet in the land. That attempt to live aloof utterly failed the Mennonites when the revolution broke out. They were completely unprepared for the violence that happened. And in retrospect victim narratives, they won't lead to healing, and if they ignore these profound contradictions in which the Mennonites were caught. Political violence, and this is a tricky one, but an important one, political violence always has a double message. On one hand, it surely functions to terrorize and dominate those it targets. Obviously, the Klan was meaning to terrorize the labor organizers. Obviously, the McNevis were meaning to terrorize and force Mennonites to submit. And this sort of domination obviously has to be resisted at every turn. On the other hand, this kind of political violence almost always encodes this hidden message of brokenness among the perpetrators, what Longfellow called the secret history of our enemies. Nelson Johnson, for example, was very clear that most of the Klansmen and Nazis involved in the 1979 massacre were just pawns in the larger power dynamics of race and class in the South. They were poor whites. They were also victims. They were simply misdirecting their rage at him. He, even as a victim of that violence, was able to see that. And that helped him speak to them. And actually, in one extraordinary session, Nelson was pastoring these white Klansmen, not former Klansmen, and offering forgiveness because he could feel empathy for the fact that they, too, were marginalized in the South. To be sure, the greater the historic repression, the more spectacular the reactive violence. This is really important to understand in the case of the McNevis in Ukraine. These were people who were just really a generation and a half removed from serfdom. They had been non-entities for centuries. The 20th century was dawning with industrialization, and they found themselves again falling deeper and deeper into poverty. That sort of incredible historic pressure, when it is finally unleashed, leads to all sorts of incredible mayhem that's completely irrational, cutting people's heads off and putting them at the dinner table. That sort of rage, the more severe the repression, the more spectacular the violence. So it obviously takes immense nonviolent character, deep Christian insight, to be able to look beneath the brutality for that encrypted cry for help. How might Mennonites, in retrospect, explore that hidden message beneath the terrible violations of the McNevists? It's asking a lot, but it is gospel mission. So given that, sort of the last issue we want to put on the table is, given the fact that political violence is always multivalent, with deep and complex causes and often irrational expressions, is traditional Mennonite pacifism sufficient? It certainly did not appear to be sufficient in the case of Ukraine. So just as Nelson Johnson looked to the Kingian tradition of nonviolence to find resources to resist and transform the legacy of the Greensboro massacre, how today might Mennonites study Gandhian methods of nonviolent resistance to help prevent or contain future elements of this kind of violence and violation? Well, these are interesting questions which maybe we can kick around together, but I'll turn it over one more time to Elaine.
As we ponder these questions, the work of healing and reconciliation must go forward. And I want to illustrate two venues which currently are being explored by Mennonites pertaining to this more complex legacy. Stony Hill, Saskatchewan is a broad mound that provides an impressive view of the valley between the North and South Saskatchewan River. It is situated near the center of a 78-square-kilometer triangle tract of land selected by Chief Young Chippewyan and the Plains Cree Band in exchange for signing Treaty No. 6 in 1876. The band lost this land in 1897 when the federal government, without consultation or compensation, assigned it to be part of a larger area reserved for Mennonite settlers. In August 2006, a celebration marking the 130th anniversary of the signing of Treaty 6 took place at Stony Hill. It was organized by Chief Ben Weeney and other descendants of the Young Chippewyan Band, the Office of the Treaty Commissioner, representatives from Mennonite and Lutheran churches in the area, and by MCC Saskatchewan's Aboriginal Neighbors Program. About 130 people participated in the celebration, which included a pipe ceremony and signing a memorandum of understanding to live in peace. At the same time, conversations continue between MCC leaders, local landowners, and tribal members about how to correct the historical disenfranchisement of the Young Chippewyan Band. It's a small effort, but it has great promise for wider provincial issues of Native rights, and it invites Mennonites to practice restorative justice as part of their own healing. The other venue is in Ukraine itself. In 2000, Mennonites purchased the former Mennonite girls' school, the Mädchenschule, in Molochansk, Hauptstadt, as the focus for a program of Mennonite humanitarian assistance in southern Ukraine. In 2001, the Mennonite Center opened its doors, and over the last 10 years has developed many programs, such as respite care, a center in Molochansk Hospital, elder care, and supporting music programs for children. Ukraine used to be the breadbasket for all of Russia. Now most farmers barely subsist on very small acreages. MEDA, Mennonite Economic Development Agency, is very active with Ukrainian farmers, working alongside the Canadian International Development Agency and three Ukrainian agencies to provide assistance to create a new cooperative system, to develop technology relevant to their crops, and for farmers to access capital to buy assets. These are small but substantive measures are part of the fabric of restorative justice and the healing of historic wounds. They are signposts for the mission of the church in an age of protracted violence, entrenched injustice, and traumatized communities. As we ponder these formidable but ultimately transforming tasks, I want to close by inviting you to sing with me a hymn that was and is very important in our tradition. It sustained Russian Mennonites through their hardest times. At the train station in Lichtenau, Ukraine, between 1923 and 1928, some 20,000 Mennonite refugees boarded for the long journey to Canada. Theirs was a bittersweet goodbye, for while they were grateful to be escaping Russia, they were leaving their loved ones behind, knowing they would never see them again. Once the train crossed the border into Latvia, the refugees would sing, "Nun danket Olle Gott." Last month, about 30 of us stood at the Lichtenau station and sang again, "Nun danket Olle Gott," in remembrance.
So I think we might have a few minutes for questions, comments. Do you want to explore any of these? Well, we realize we're mostly presented questions and conundrums, but that's how we do our best work. So I think we have time for just a few questions before we end this evening.
Yes.
I'm sure somewhere in both of your presentations you meant this, but my background is Mennonite Brethren and all the rest of that.
Yeah.
But I didn't hear you speak specifically to the problem of cultural context. The necessary link in terms of the Mennonite Brethren in Russia and Germany, and they brought that with them into Canada. My own experience was a beautiful one in that church leaders realized that that language barrier between the church membership, refugees, the German, was something that had to be conquered, but without splitting the church. And that was the real problem. And you probably know Frank Peters.
Yeah.
He was the one who pastored the church, did a beautiful job of, you know, a kind of justice understanding that took the people with him.
And I know, well, you know, I spoke German when I was a kid. That was the language that I learnt in my family. I was the youngest. My oldest sister is still fluent, and I can understand to some degree, but that was the language that we spoke at home, and it was the language that was in the church when I was a little girl, and that struggle that you speak of changing to English and then losing some of our distinctiveness in that was that was hard, particularly for my grandparents and parents' generation. And now, of course, actually my nephew does speak German, but losing that distinctiveness is important. Did you relate to that?
Yeah, and it's also important to remember that you know, cultural transformation always takes place within a wider distribution of social power. And part of the problem with Mennonites living for 150 years in Ukraine with German as their primary language was not so much the language in and of itself, but a certain amount of conscious or unconscious cultural chauvinism, which was very much the case for the Russian Mennonites. They really, in many ways, thought they were superior to the Ukrainian peasants because they came from this great high German culture. So that's a little bit of an inconvenient truth. It's never just about language. Retaining language is one of the most important things, particularly that minority groups can do as a way of retaining their identity. But how do those languages figure in the larger issue of social power? So Cree tribes in Saskatchewan who are trying now to rebuild their language and recover their language and actually are one of the successful stories of linguistic rehabilitation, that's about rebuilding their esteem. Because you know they're a culture that's been completely marginalized. So how culture how language functions in the matrix of social power is part of that complexity that we have to look at. But that's a really great story that you offer there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kent.
Just talking about telling the whole truth, and you made a lot of connections between Johnson and the Martin Luther King tradition and this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I know there's also a civil trial to find out the truth about Martin Luther King's assassination. And how important is it for Americans to remember some of the truth about deaths like King's and the Kennedys and other, you know, these are prominent examples, obviously, compared to, but just to know that there was actually the civil case that uncovered conspiracy and complicity on the governmental level, local, and otherwise. I don't know if you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure.
This is a chance to tell about that truth, you know, Americans don't know.
Right.
Thanks, Kent. Yeah, in 1999, the King family brought a suit against the federal government in order primarily to try to get access to classified records concerning the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968. The trial was held in Memphis, the place where King was shot down. And after days and days and days of testimony, the trial concluded with the evidence showing that, yes, in fact, the government, that King was the victim of a government conspiracy. And the evidence was carefully sorted through. And this was proven in a court of law in the fall of 1999 in Memphis. Not one single major paper in the United States reported that as front page news. In fact, it was later nominated as one of the most underreported great stories of the year. There simply was little interest. And therein lies the conundrum. You can expose the truth and nobody can care. That's not a small finding. And it's terribly important if we're going to understand the meaning of the life and death of Dr. King and what that means for our culture. But it's also true that we North Americans are very poor at revisiting our histories. And that's in part because we've built our cultural identity on erasing the past behind us as we go. Now, that tends to be pretty convenient for an empire. Because there's so much damage, such a trail of tears behind us, that we have an investment in not revisiting it. That has got to change, and I think the more that truth and reconciliation work is done, perhaps we'll begin to get practiced more at it as a culture. It's apropos to mention in that vein that one of my mentors, Jim Douglas, has been working for 10 years on a book that tries to revisit the story of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and published a book 2 years ago called JFK, Why He Died and Why It Matters. and it's one of these big 500-page books. It's being reissued this month. This is the 50th anniversary this month of the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. And it's being reissued as a trade book by Touchstone Press. It's gotten a lot of play. It's really gotten the attention of a lot of people, including the Kennedy family. And the Kennedy family, members of the Kennedy family who are now grandchildren, are wanting to speak out and say, we think this book tells the truth, but they're still afraid. So these are efforts, large and small, famous and forgotten, that all contribute to trying to heal wounds by telling the whole truth. And it's never a simple soundbite.
In that regard, you could go down to Greensboro to the new Civil Rights Museum in the old Woolworth building, and it doesn't mention the Klan killings.
Yep.
In the 80s.
Well, they're working on that.
Yeah.
They're still struggling to get that story told. And that's ironic, because the very same people that animated the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation process community organized to get that museum built. They're still trying to get the story of 1960 told truthfully. And so it's ironic that, you know, that doesn't yet tell the story of the massacre. But this is a community that's been in struggle for the truth for generations, and they realize that you got to take it piece by piece. So, you know, for years and years in downtown Greensboro, that Woolworth's store was vacated and empty and collecting dust. And it was only through the community organizing of the Beloved Community Center and others that that museum finally got done. And so now the museum is there, and we want the whole truth to be told. Same is true of the King Museum in Memphis. Tells a great tells well the story of the Civil Rights Movement, does not tell well the story of Dr. King's assassination. So there's lots to be done. Let's see if some of our female participants might want to get in a question here. Yes.
Among the groups that were involved in the massacre, period. In terms of African Americans that are certainly not of one mind as to what happened and who was hurt more than others, and then European Americans or whites who feel like, well, there were some really racist folks, but I wasn't part of that. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's all the black folks one thing and all the white folks doing another thing, and the blacks were all the victims, and the whites were trapped into that, and the whites maybe having experienced oppression. But it gets really complex.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The longer the time period goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing some work in Front Royal, Virginia, where I'm seeing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting, it makes things like discussions of poverty really difficult.
Let me take that and then throw the ball to you and talk about the circles you did on the 30th anniversary.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. The truth is always complicated, and unless and until we are willing to work with the nuancing and the complexity and to acknowledge it, then we're going to be not doing much more than the way the media spins it in misrepresentative sound bites. In the case of Greensboro, it was surely the case that the black community was divided after the massacre, just as, you know, the majority of the black community was never in support of the civil rights movement anywhere in this country. And part of that was for the same reason why Mennonites wanted to keep their heads down. You know, it's dangerous when you start marching and drawing attention to yourself. Mm-hmm. After the massacre of November 3rd, people like Nelson and Joyce couldn't find refuge anywhere. Certainly not in the white community, but not much in the black community, except for the local black newspaper. Few pastors who would privately, but he was really on his own. He was extremely isolated.
As all of the communist worker parties were. I mean, there were white folks that were a part of that as well. They mm-hmm. were all isolated.
Yeah, they couldn't get jobs. They couldn't rent apartments. I mean, they were completely shut out of town.
Mm-hmm.
When Nelson finally went to jail for inciting a riot, the only person who came to visit him was a white Presbyterian pastor by the name of Z. Holler. We're going to be going to stay at Z's house tomorrow night. He's just a wonderful old Southern gentleman of a Presbyterian pastor who alone took courage. And Nelson was so impressed by that this white Presbyterian guy would come visit him in jail, that he started reading his Bible again and eventually returned to his childhood faith, went back to seminary, became a pastor. That's the mystery of how history works. At the same time, within that complexity, there are pretty discernible patterns, and those discernible patterns really do break down along racial lines by and large, so that when Elaine and I were involved in the 30th anniversary, 35th, what was it?
Doesn't matter. I can't do the math right now.
Yeah, 30th anniversary last year, this time last year, in Greensboro. And there's a lot of organizing that went into that, and both locally and nationally. And we still couldn't get white clergy to come support that thing. 30 years later, two white clergy, Z. Holler and one other person. So, you know, there are patterns, and then there are exceptions to the pattern. You sort of have to look at all of it. There are some extraordinary things that happened at that 30th anniversary. Mm-hmm. I want to invite Elaine to tell about some healing work that she did.
Yeah, I was invited to facilitate some healing circles there, and I didn't quite know what to expect. A number of the folks are still a part of that communist working party, and I was a little anxious about what that would look like. So I designed a process of concentric circles and tried to talk about this journey from victim to survivor, to healer, and set up a context. And we sat down with the survivors first, and it was amazing. The tears that flowed, survivors told their story, then their children came into the circle and told their story, and community members then came into that, you know, inner circle with everybody listening and told their story. And I knew it was a powerful time. But afterwards, it even struck me more that these survivors of the massacre just said, all these years of working toward their own healing, they are still looking for safe, supportive places to tell their story. And they were so grateful that this space had been created. And it did make me wonder, what have they been doing, you know, to try and transcend this? But political work is so hard. You know, the fight to get the truth out had to come first. And then with this commemoration, 30 years later, the Truth Commission report had been out for a couple years, and they could just let it all out. So it was a beautiful, very powerful experience to me, and then a reminder of how that victimization is so lodged in our bones, and in this work, we need to keep creating those safe spaces and invite people to go to those places of violation. And the story continues. Nelson's daughter was, and this is what she just wept about in this circle, she was 2 months earlier had been voted the best nurse in this hospital where she was working. And then someone found out who she was, that she was the daughter of Nelson Johnson, and she was fired just like that. And now she can't get a job as a nurse in Greensboro, and they have to move. And so there is no end to this. And she was a 7-year-old girl, and she was there at the march, and she saw her Aunt Sandy murdered, shot right between the eyes. And so we, you know, 30 years later, the need to keep telling this story. So for me to go back 100 years, you saw me with my tears up here. My grandparents are long gone. My parents are gone. And yet those stories are still here. And we need to find safe places to face the hard truths about the entire story. Yeah. You, friends, are my second try. So thank you. You are my safe try. I preached a couple Sundays ago at Pasadena Mennonite Church, where I don't know how many folks would be Mennonite there. It's a very, you know, diverse crowd. Folks have joined the Mennonite Church but don't carry the Mennonite story. There was one gentleman there that cried through the whole thing and was very supportive of me. So you all are my second time. Yeah, it's very new. It's very fresh. I prepared these comments for you all, and I don't know how that's going to go.
But this, we're very intentional about trying to do this work, and it's not going to be kindly received in some circles because there are some circles that are committed to having a one-dimensional story of victimization, idealization of how Mennonites were. And, you know, pure victimization, sort of self-exonerating. And how do we sensitively look at that truth, but also look at more complex truth? And, you know, the question may arise, why bother? I mean, why let this sleeping dog lie? And we think it has a lot to do with the future of the work of restorative justice. You know, Mennonites are involved all over the world in trauma situations, in situations of violence, trying to be peacemakers, trying to do restorative justice. You know, and that outward journey is something that Mennonites are famous for. The Mennonites also have to do an inward journey, individually and collectively, to look at their own history of both victimization, but also, like, the question we ask around Mennonite affluence obviously is a pretty relevant question today. How is the increasing middle class affluence of the Mennonite church going to slowly but surely undermine the Mennonite witness of solidarity with marginalized people? And the sort of conventional middle-class churchly wisdom, well, let's get prosperous so we can help other people, that's not going to get it done, because that didn't get it done in the history of the Mennonite experience. So again, there are psychological reasons to revisit these stories, both intrapsychically and collectively, but there are also real social, political, theological reasons to look at this, because precisely, Mennonite identity as a disarmed community trying to follow the way of Jesus, which is about justice and solidarity and compassion, all the things that Myron talks about, is such a unique and difficult way to do as a community. And we all need to help each other learn from the past, and particularly around the question of Mennonite pacifism. Mm-hmm. It's still a big debate in the church. A lot of people think non-resistance is really the tradition, and all this militant troublemaking non-violence is not the tradition. And I think the story of Ukraine really asks all kinds of questions about how can a pacifist community train itself in nonviolent resistance, so it's not taken by surprise when forces of violence are turned directly upon it. So we have some tools. Those tools are out there. It's highly ironic that in 1919, when Machnow is having dinner at Grandma Schultz's house, Mahatma Gandhi is beginning his experiments in Satyagraha in India. We've got to learn from all of that, it seems to me, as a peace church.
I'll take him with me. I'm anxious about it. I have uncles, and it'll slowly come about, but I feel that as well. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak this with a group that some of, I know not all of you are Mennonites, but many of you are, and look forward to continuing the dialogue to be able to raise these. Part of my motivation as well is that a number of my nieces and nephews have left the church, and I think in some ways it feels irrelevant to them. And I want to make this Mennonite faith at least something that they take seriously, and then they can choose it not. But I want them to wrestle with it. And partly I think why they're not taking it seriously is that they do see all these contradictions. And they're not impressed by that. And so part of my motivation for writing this is for my own health, but it's also to animate the church and get the younger folks to engage it. Because it is a beautiful tradition, and it is referred to often. I'm often in places where I'm the only Mennonite, and someone will say, "Oh, I love the Mennonites." I just think, "Oh man, I don't always feel like we're worthy of such love." We got a lot of work to do, and I want the church to be relevant to my nieces and nephews, so that they find passion there, like I have found.
So. We'll hang around a little bit. I think in interests of the process, we should probably give some of you a chance to leave. We'll hang around. But I don't know how within bounds this is, but could I invite Myron to come up and maybe give a little bit of a benediction? We've arrived at, if you would be willing, we've arrived at the end of this this year's Augsburger Lectures. We've really appreciated the hospitality and interest. I hope... you feel like we've told some stories and read some scripture and done a little analysis and raised some issues that will be useful to all of you in your ongoing work. Again, thanks to Myron, and wondering if you would close us out with a benediction.
This is a remarkable couple, remarkable presentation. Join me in thanking them. Thank you very much. And I'm grateful you're not ashamed to be Mennonite.
Oh, I'm very glad.
Let's pray. As we part, may the Lord lift you up. May the Lord take your hand. May the Lord lead you forth and cause you to stand, secure in God's word, seeking God's face, abounding in love, abiding in grace. Go in his peace, his joy, his mission. In the name of Christ, amen.